there. I'm sorry, Sylvia. You forgive me for speaking about it.
Forgive you for what?
Always talk about it, and about anything. Don't you know all writers ever talk about is their troubles? But promise me you won't worry, and that you'll eat enough.
I promise.
Then get home now and have lunch. Outside on the Rue de l'Odéon, I was disgusted with myself for having complained about things. I was doing what I did of my own free will, and I was doing it stupidly. I should have bought a large piece of bread and eaten it instead of skipping a meal. I could taste the brown, lovely crust. But it is dry in your mouth without something to drink. You goddamn complainer. You dirty, phony saint and martyr, I said to myself. You quit journalism of your own accord. You have credit, and Sylvia would have loaned you money. She has plenty of times. Sure, and then the next thing you would be compromising on something else. Hunger is healthy, and the pictures do look better when you are hungry. Eating is wonderful, too, and do you know where you are going to eat right now? Lips is where you are going to eat, and drink, too. It was a quick walk to Lips, and every place I passed that my stomach noticed as quickly as my eyes or my nose made the walk an added pleasure. There were few people in the brasserie, and when I sat down on the bench against the wall with the mirror in back and a table in front and the waiter asked if I wanted a beer, I asked for a distingue, the big glass mug that held a liter, and for potato salad. The beer was very cold and wonderful to drink. The pommes à l'huile were firm and marinated, and the olive oil delicious. I ground black pepper over the potatoes and moistened the bread in the olive oil. After the first heavy draught of beer, I drank and ate very slowly. When the pommes à l'huile were gone, I ordered another serving and a cervelas. This was a sausage like a heavy, wide frankfurter, split in two and covered with a special mustard sauce. I mopped up all the oil and all of the sauce with bread and drank the beer slowly until it began to lose its coldness. And then I finished it and ordered a demi and watched it drawn. It seemed colder than the distingue, and I drank half of it. I had not been worrying, I thought. I knew the stories were good, and someone would publish them finally at home. When I stopped doing newspaper work, I was sure the stories were going to be published. But every one I sent out came back. What had made me so confident was Edward O'Brien's taking the My Old Man story for the best short stories book and then dedicating the book for that year to me. Then I laughed and drank some more beer. The story had never been published in a magazine, and he had broken all his rules to take it for the book. I laughed again, and the waiter glanced at me. It was funny because, after all that, he had spelled the name wrong. It was one of two stories I had left when everything I had written was stolen in Hadley's suitcase that time at the Gare de Lyon when she was bringing the manuscripts down to me to Lausanne as a surprise, so I could work on them on our holidays in the mountains. She had put in the originals, the typescripts, and the carbons, all in these manila folders. The only reason I had the one story was that Lincoln Steffens had sent it out to some editor who sent it back. It was in the mail while everything else was stolen. The other story that I had was the one called Up in Michigan, written before Miss Stein had come to our flat, that I had never had copied because she said it was inaccrochable. It had been in a drawer somewhere. So after we had left Lausanne and gone down to Italy, I showed the racing story to O'Brien, a gentle, shy man, pale with pale blue eyes, and straight, lanky hair he cut himself, who lived then as a boarder in a monastery up above Rapallo. It was a bad time, and I did not think I could write any more then, and I showed the story to him as a curiosity, as you might show, stupidly, the binnacle of a ship you had lost in some incredible way, or as you might pick up your booted foot if it had been amputated after a crash and made some joke about it. Then, when he read the story, I saw he was hurt far more than I was. I had never seen anyone hurt by a thing other than death or unbearable suffering, except Hadley when she told me about the things being gone. She had cried and cried and could not tell me. I told her that no matter what the dreadful thing was that had happened, nothing could be that bad, and whatever it was all right and not to worry. We would work it out. Then, finally, she told me. I was sure she could not have brought the Carbons, too, and I hired someone to cover for me on my newspaper job. I was making good money then at journalism, and took the train for Paris. It was true, all right, and I remember what I did in the night after I let myself into the flat and found it was true. That was over now, and Chink had taught me never to discuss casualties, so I told O'Brien not to feel so badly. It was probably good for me to lose early work, and I told him all that stuff you feed the troops. I was going to start writing stories again, I said, and as I said it, only trying to lie so that he would not feel so badly, I knew that it was true. Then I started to think in lips about when I had first been able to write a story after losing everything. It was up in Cortina d'Ampezzo when I had come back to join Hadley there after the spring skiing, which I had to interrupt to go on assignment to the Rhineland and the Ruhr. It was a very simple story called Out of Season, and I had omitted the real end of it, which was that the old man hanged himself. This was omitted on my new theory that you could omit anything if you knew that you omitted, and the omitted part would strengthen the story and make people feel something more than they understood. Well, I thought, now I have them, so they do not understand them. There cannot be much doubt about that. There is most certainly no demand for them. But they will understand the same way that they always do in painting. It only takes time, and it only needs confidence. It is necessary to handle yourself better when you have to cut down on food so you will not get too much hunger thinking. Hunger is good discipline, and you learn from it, but you can work something out. And as long as they do not understand it, you are ahead of them. Oh, sure, I thought. I'm so far ahead of them now that I can't afford to eat regularly. It would not be bad if they caught up a little. I knew I must write a novel, but it seemed an impossible thing to do when I had been trying with great difficulty to write paragraphs that would be the distillation of what made a novel. It was necessary to write longer stories now as you would train for a longer race. When I had written a novel before, the one that had been lost in the bag stolen at the Gare de Lyon, I still had the lyric facility of boyhood that was as perishable and as deceptive as youth was. I knew it was probably a good thing that it was lost, but I knew, too, that I must write a novel. I would put it off, though, until I could not help doing it. I was damned if I would write one, because it was what I should do if we were to eat regularly. When I had to write it, then it would be the only thing to do, and there would be no choice. Let the pressure build. In the meantime, I would write a long story about whatever I knew best. By this time I had paid the check and gone out and turned to the right and crossed the Rue de Rennes so that I would not go to the Deux Magots for coffee and was walking up the Rue Bonaparte on the shortest way home. What did I know best that I had not written about and lost? What did I know about truly and care for the most? There was no choice at all. There was only the choice of streets to take you back fastest to where you worked. I went up Bonaparte to Guynemer, then to the Rue d'Assas, across the Rue Notre-Dame-des-Champs to the Closerie des Lilas. I sat in a corner with the afternoon light coming in over my shoulder and wrote in the notebook. The waiter brought me a café crème, and I drank half of it when it cooled and left it on the table while I wrote. When I stopped writing, I did not want to leave the river, where I could see the trout in the pool, its surface pushing and swelling smooth against the resistance of the log-driven piles of the bridge. The story was about coming back from the war, but there was no mention of the war in it. But in the morning the river would be there, and I must make it, and the country, and all that would happen. There were days ahead to be doing that each day. No other thing mattered. In my pocket was the money from Germany, so there was no problem. When that was gone, some other money would come in. All I must do now was stay sound and good in my head until morning, when I would start to work again. In those days, we never thought that any of that could be difficult. 9. Ford Madox Ford and the Devil's Disciple. The Closerie des Lilas was the nearest good café when we lived down the Rue Notre-Dame des Champs, in the top floor of the pavilion, in the courtyard with a sawmill, and it was one of the nicest cafés in Paris. It was warm inside in the winter, and in the spring and fall it was very fine outside, with the tables under the shade of the trees on the side where the statue of Marshal Ney was, and the square, regular tables under the big awnings along the boulevard. Two of the waiters were our good friends. People from the Dôme and the Rotonde never came to the Lilas. There was no one there they knew, and no one would have stared at them if they came. In those days, many people went to the cafés at the corner of the Boulevard Montparnasse and the Boulevard Raspail to be seen publicly, and in a way such places anticipated the columnists as the daily substitutes for immortality. The Closerie des Lilas had once been a café where poets met more or less regularly, and the last principal poet had been Paul Faure, whom I had never read. But the only poet I ever saw there was Blaise Cendrat, with his broken boxer's face and his pinned-up empty sleeve, rolling a cigarette with his one good hand. He was a good companion until he drank too much, and at that time, when he was lying, he was more interesting than many men telling a story truly. But he was the only poet who came to the Lilas then, and I only saw him there once. Most of the clients knew each other only to nod, and there were elderly bearded men in well-worn clothes who came with their wives or their mistresses and wore or did not wear thin red Legion of Honor ribbons in their lapels. We thought of them all hopefully as scientists or savants, and they sat almost as long over an aperitif as the men in shabbier clothes who sat with their wives or mistresses over a café crème and wore the purple ribbon of the palms of the academy, which had nothing to do with the French academy, and meant, we thought, that they were professors or instructors. These people made it a comfortable café, since they were all interested in each other, and in their drinks or coffees or infusions, and in the papers and periodicals which were fastened to rods, and no one was on exhibition. There were other people, too, who lived in the quarter and came to the Lilas, and some of them wore Croix de Guerre ribbons in their lapels, and others also had the yellow and green of the Médaille Militaire. And I watched to notice how well they were overcoming the handicap of the loss of limbs, or at the quality of their artificial eyes and the degree of skill with which their faces had been reconstructed. There was always an almost iridescent, shiny cast about the considerably reconstructed face, rather like that of a well-packed ski run, and we respected these clients more than we did the savants or the professors, although the latter might well have done their military service too, without experiencing mutilation. In those days, we did not trust anyone who had not been in the war, but we did not completely trust anyone, and there was a strong feeling that Cendrat, our only poet, might well be a little less flashy about his vanished arm. I was glad he had been in the Lilas early in the afternoon, before the regular clients had arrived. On this evening, I was sitting at a table outside of the Lilas, watching the light change on the trees and the buildings and the passage of the great slow horses of the outer boulevards. The door of the café opened behind me and to my right, and a man came out and walked to my table.
"Oh, here you are," he said.
It was Ford Madox Ford, as he called himself then, and he was breathing heavily through a heavy, stained mustache, and holding himself as upright as an ambulatory, well-clothed, up-ended hogshead.
"May I sit with you?"
he asked, sitting down. And his eyes, which were a washed-out blue under colorless lids and eyebrows, looked out at the boulevard.
I spent good years of my life that those beasts should be slaughtered humanely, he said.
You told me, I said.
I don't think so.
I'm quite sure.
Very odd. I've never told anyone in my life.
Will you have a drink? The waiter stood there, and Ford told him he would have a Chambéry cassis. The waiter, who was tall and thin and bald on the top of his head, with hair slicked over and who wore a heavy old-style dragoon mustache, repeated the order.
No, make it a finalot, Ford said.
A finalot for monsieur, the waiter confirmed the order. I had always avoided looking at Ford when I could, and I always held my breath when I was near him in a closed room. But this was the open air, and the fallen leaves blew along the sidewalks from my side of the table past his. So I took a good look at him, repented, and looked across the boulevard. The light was changed again, and I had missed the change. I took a drink to see if his coming had fouled it, but it still tasted good.
You're very glum, he said.
No.
Yes, you are. You need to get out more. I stopped by to ask you to the little evenings we're giving in that amusing bal musette near the Place Contrescarpe on the Rue Cardinal Moin.
I lived above it for 2 years before you came to Paris this last time.
How odd. Are you sure?
Yes, I said. I'm sure. The man who owned it had a taxi, and when I had to get a plane, he'd take me out to the field, and we'd stop at the zinc bar of the Bal and drink a glass of white wine in the dark before we'd start for the airfield.
I've never cared for flying, Ford said. You and your wife plan to come to the Bal Musette Saturday night. It's quite gay. I'll draw you a map so you can find it. I stumbled on it quite by chance.
It's under 74 Rue Cardinal Lemoyne, I said. I lived on the third floor.
There's no number, Ford said, but you'll be able to find it if you can find the Place Contrescarpe.
I took another long drink. The waiter had brought Ford's drink, and Ford was correcting him.
It wasn't a brandy and soda, he said, helpfully but severely. I ordered a Chambéry vermouth and cassis.
It's all right, Jean, I said. I'll take the fiend. Bring monsieur what he orders now.
What I ordered, corrected Ford.
At that moment, a rather gaunt man wearing a cape passed on the sidewalk. He was with a tall woman, and he glanced at our table, and then away, and went on his way down the boulevard.
Did you see me cut him?
Ford said.
Did you see me cut him?
No. Who did you cut?
Belloc,
Ford said.
Did I cut him?
I didn't see it, I said. Why did you cut him?
For every good reason in the world, Ford said. Did I cut him, though?
He was thoroughly and completely happy. I had never seen Belloc, and I did not believe he had seen us. He looked like a man who had been thinking of something and had glanced at the table almost automatically. I felt badly that Ford had been rude to him, as, being a young man who was commencing his education, I had a high regard for him as an older writer. This is not understandable now, but in those days it was a common occurrence. I thought it might have been pleasant if Belloc had stopped at the table and I might have met him. The afternoon had been spoiled by seeing Ford, but I thought Belloc might have made it better.
"What are you drinking brandy for?" Ford asked me. "Don't you know it's fatal for a young writer to start drinking brandy?"
"I don't drink it very often," I said. I was trying to remember what Ezra Pound had told me about Ford, that I must never be rude to him, that I must remember that he only lied when he was very tired, that he was really a good writer, and that he had been through very bad domestic troubles. I tried hard to think of these things, but the heavy, wheezing, ignoble presence of Ford himself, only touching distance away, made it difficult, but I tried. "Tell me why one cuts people," I asked. Until then, I had thought it was something only done in novels by Ouida. I had never been able to read a novel by Ouida, not even at some skiing place in Switzerland where reading matter had run out when the wet south wind had come and there were only the left-behind Tauchnitz editions of Before the War. But I was sure, by some sixth sense, that people cut one another in her novels.
"A gentleman," Ford explained, "will always cut a cad."
I took a quick drink of the brandy. "Would he cut a bounder?" I asked.
"It would be impossible for a gentleman to have known a bounder."
"Then you can only cut someone you have known on terms of equality," I pursued.
"Naturally."
"How would one ever meet a cad?"
"You might not know it, or the fellow could have become a cad."
"What is a cad?" I asked. "Isn't he someone that one has to thrash within an inch of his life?"
"Not necessarily," Ford said.
"Is Ezra a gentleman?" I asked.
"Of course not," Ford said. "He's an American."
"Can't an American be a gentleman?"
"Perhaps John Quinn," Ford explained. "Certain of your ambassadors."
"Myron T. Herrick?"
"Possibly."
"Was Henry James a gentleman?"
"Very nearly."
"Are you a gentleman?"
"Naturally. I have held His Majesty's commission."
"It's very complicated," I said. "Am I a gentleman?"
"Absolutely not," Ford said.
"Then why are you drinking with me?"
"I'm drinking with you as a promising young writer, as a fellow writer, in fact."
"Good of you," I said.
"You might be considered a gentleman in Italy," Ford said, magnanimously.
"But I'm not a cad?"
"Of course not, dear boy. Whoever said such a thing?"
"I might become one," I said sadly, drinking brandy and all. "That was what did it for Lord Harry Hotspur and Trollope. Tell me, was Trollope a gentleman?"
"Of course not."
"You're sure?"
"There might be two opinions, but not in mine."
"Was Fielding? He was a judge."
"Technically, perhaps."
"Marlowe?"
"Of course not."
"John Donne?"
"He was a parson."
"It's fascinating," I said.
"I'm glad you're interested," Ford said. "I'll have a brandy and water with you before you go."
After Ford left, it was dark, and I walked over to the kiosk and bought a Paris Sport Complet, the final edition of the afternoon racing paper with the results at Auteuil, and the line on the next day's meeting at Enghien. The waiter, Emile, who had replaced Jean on duty, came to the table to see the results of the last race at Auteuil. A great friend of mine, who rarely came to the Lila, came over to the table and sat down. And just then, as my friend was ordering a drink from Emile, the gaunt man in the cape with the tall woman passed us on a sidewalk. His glance drifted toward the table and then away. "That's Hilaire Belloc," I said to my friend. "Ford was here this afternoon and cut him dead." "Don't be a silly ass," my friend said. "That's Alastair Crowley, the Diabolist. He's supposed to be the wickedest man in the world." "Sorry," I said. 10. With Pasquin at the Dome. It was a lovely evening, and I had worked hard all day and left the flat where we lived over the sawmill at 113 Rue Notre-Dame-des-Champs, and walked out through the courtyard with the stacked lumber, closed the door, crossed the street, and went into the back door of the bakery that fronted on the Boulevard Montparnasse and out through the good bread smells of the ovens and the shop to the street. The lights were on in the bakery, and outside it was the end of the day, and I walked in the early dusk up the street and stopped outside the terrace of the Nègre de Toulouse restaurant where our red and white checkered napkins were in the wooden napkin rings in the napkin rack waiting for us to come to dinner. I read the menu mimeographed in purple ink and saw that the plat du jour was cassoulet. It made me hungry to read the name. Mr. Lavigne, the proprietor, asked me how my work had gone, and I said it had gone very well. He said he had seen me working on the terrace of the Closerie des Lilas early in the morning, but he had not spoken to me because I was so occupied.
"You had the air of a man alone in the jungle," he said.
"I am like a blind pig when I work."
"But were you not in the jungle, monsieur?"
"In the bush," I said. I went on up the street looking in the windows and happy with the spring evening and the people coming past. In the three principal cafes, I saw people that I knew by sight and others that I knew to speak to. But there were always much nicer-looking people that I did not know that, in the evening, with the lights just coming on, were hurrying to some place to drink together, to eat together, and then to make love. The people in the principal cafes might do the same thing, or they might just sit and drink and talk and love to be seen by others. The people that I liked and had not met went to the big cafes because they were lost in them, and no one noticed them, and they could be alone in them and be together. The big cafes were cheap then, too, and all had good beer, and the aperitifs cost reasonable prices that were clearly marked on the saucers that were served with them. On this evening, I was thinking these wholesome, unoriginal thoughts and feeling extraordinarily virtuous because I had worked well and hard on a day when I had wanted to go out to the races very badly. It was necessary to give up going racing in the time of our real poverty, and I was still too close to that poverty to risk any money. By any standards, we were still very poor, and I still made such small economies as saying that I had been asked out for lunch and then spending 2 hours walking in the Luxembourg Gardens and coming back to describe the marvelous lunch to my wife. When you are 25 and are a natural heavyweight, missing a meal completely makes you very hungry. But it also sharpens all of your perceptions, and I found that many of the people I wrote about had very strong appetites and a great taste and desire for food, and most of them were looking forward to having a drink. At the Negre de Toulouse, we drank the good Cahors wine from the quarter, the half, or the full carafe, usually diluting it about one-third with water. At home over the sawmill, we had a Corsican wine that had great authority and a low price. It was a very Corsican wine, and you could dilute it by half with water and still receive its message. In Paris, then, you could live very well on almost nothing, and by skipping meals occasionally and never buying any new clothes, you could save and have luxuries. But at this time I could not afford to go to the races, even though there was money to be made there if you worked at it. It was before the days of saliva tests and other methods of detecting artificially encouraged horses, and doping was very extensively practiced. But handicapping beasts that are receiving stimulants and detecting the symptoms in the paddock and acting on your perceptions, which sometimes bordered on the extrasensory, then backing them with money you cannot afford to lose, is not the way for a young man supporting a wife and child to get ahead in the full-time job of learning to write prose. Coming back from the Select now, where I had sheered off at the sight of Harold Stearns, who I knew would want to talk horses, those animals I was thinking of righteously and lightheartedly as boosted beasts that I had just forsworn at Enghien to work on this day as a serious writer. Now full of my evening virtue, I passed the collection of inmates of the Rotonde, and, scorning vice and the collective instinct, crossed the boulevard to the Dome. The Dome was crowded too, but there were people there who had worked. There were models who had worked, and there were painters who had worked until the light was gone, and there were writers who had finished a day's work, for better or for worse. And there were drinkers and characters, some of whom I knew, and some that were only decoration. I went over and sat with Pasquin and two models, who were sisters. Pasquin had waved to me while I had stood on the sidewalk on the Rue de l'Ombre side, wondering whether to stop and have a drink or not. Pasquin was a very good painter, and he was drunk, steady, purposefully drunk, and making good sense. The two models were young and pretty. One was very dark, small, beautifully built, with a falsely fragile depravity. She was a lesbian who also liked men. The other was childlike and dull, but very pretty in a perishable, childish way. She was not as well built as her sister, but neither was anyone else that spring. "The good and the bad sisters," Pasquin said. "I have money. What will you drink?"
"Un demi-blonde," I said to the waiter.
"Have a whiskey. I have money."
"I like beer."
"If you really liked beer, you'd be at Lips. I suppose you've been working?"
"Yes."
"It goes?"
"I hope so."
"Good. I'm glad. And everything still tastes good?"
"Yes."
"How old are you?"
25.
"Do you want to bang her?"
He looked toward the dark sister and smiled.
"She needs it."
"You probably banged her enough today."
She smiled at me with her lips open. "He's wicked," she said. "But he's nice." "You can take her over to the studio." "Don't make piggishness," the blonde sister said.
"Who spoke to you?"
Pasquin asked her. "Nobody, but I said it."
"Let's be comfortable," Pasquin said. "The serious young writer, and the friendly wise old painter, and the two beautiful young girls with all of life before them."
We sat there, and the girls sipped at their drinks, and Pasquin drank another finalot, and I drank the beer. But no one was comfortable except Pasquin. The dark girl was restless, and she sat on display, turning her profile and letting the light strike the concave planes of her face, and showing me her breasts under the hold of the black sweater. Her hair was cropped short and was sleek and dark as an Oriental's.
"You've posed all day," Pasquin said to her. "Do you have to model that sweater now at the cafe?"
"It pleases me," she said.
"You look like a Javanese toy," he said.
"Not the eyes," she said. "It's more complicated than that."
"You look like a poor, perverted little poupée."
"Perhaps," she said, "but alive. That's more than you."
"We'll see about that."
"Good," she said. "I like proofs."
"You didn't have any today?"
"Oh, that," she said,
and turned to catch the last evening light on her face.
"You were just excited about your work. He's in love with canvases," she said to me. "There's always some kind of dirtiness."
"You want me to paint you and pay you and bang you to keep my head clear and be in love with you too," Pasquin said. "You poor little doll."
"You like me, don't you, monsieur?" she asked me.
"Very much."
"But you're too big," she said sadly.
"Everyone is the same size in bed."
"It's not true," her sister said, "and I'm tired of this talk."
"Look," Pasquin said, "if you think I'm in love with canvases, I'll paint you tomorrow in watercolors."
"When do we eat?" her sister asked. "And where?" "Will you eat with us?" the dark girl asked.
"No, I go to eat with my légitime." That was what they said then. Now they say, "my régulière."
"You have to go?"
"Have to and want to." "Go on, then," Pasquin said. "And don't fall in love with typewriting paper."
"If I do, I'll write with a pencil."
"Watercolors tomorrow," he said. "All right, my children. I will drink another, and then we eat where you wish."
"Shea Viking," the Dark Sister said promptly. You want to contrast me with all the beautiful Nordic types? No.
I like it very much at Shea Viking, the Dark Girl said.
Me too,
her sister urged.
All right, Pasquin agreed. Good night, Junome. Sleep well.
You too.
They keep me awake, he said. I never sleep.
Sleep tonight.
After Shele Vikings?
He grinned with a hat on the back of his head. He looked more like a Broadway character of the 90s than the lovely painter that he was. And afterwards, when he had hanged himself, I liked to remember him as he was that night at the dome. They say the seeds of what we will do are in all of us. But it always seemed to me that in those who make jokes in life, the seeds are covered with better soil and with a higher grade of manure. 11. Ezra Pound and the Measuring Worm. Ezra Pound was always a good friend, and he was always doing things for people. The studio where he lived with his wife Dorothy on the Rue Notre-Dame des Champs was as poor as Gertrude Stein's studio was rich. It had very good light and was heated by a stove, and it had paintings by Japanese artists that Ezra knew. They were all noblemen where they came from and wore their hair cut long. Their hair glistened black and swung forward when they bowed, and I was very impressed by them, but I did not like their paintings. I did not understand them, but they did not have any mystery, and when I understood them, they meant nothing to me. I was sorry about this, but there was nothing I could do about it. Dorothy's paintings I liked very much, and I thought Dorothy was very beautiful and built wonderfully. I also liked The Head of Ezra by Gaudier Brzeska, and I liked all of the photographs of this sculptor's work that Ezra showed me and that were in Ezra's book about him. Ezra also liked Picabia's painting, but I thought then that it was worthless. I also disliked Wyndham Lewis's painting, which Ezra liked very much. He liked the works of his friends, which is beautiful as loyalty, but can be disastrous as judgment. We never argued about these things because I kept my mouth shut about things I did not like. If a man liked his friend's painting or writing, I thought it was probably like those people who liked their families, and it was not polite to criticize them. Sometimes you can go quite a long time before you criticize families, your own or those by marriage. But it is easier with bad painters because they do not do terrible things and make intimate harm as families can do. With bad painters, all you need to do is not look at them. But even when you have learned not to look at families nor listen to them and have learned not to answer letters, families have many ways of being dangerous. Ezra was kinder and more Christian about people than I was. His own writing, when he would hit it right, was so perfect. And he was so sincere in his mistakes, and so enamored of his errors, and so kind to people, that I always thought of him as sort of saint. He was also irascible, but so, I believe, have been many saints. Ezra wanted me to teach him to box, and it was while we were sparring late one afternoon in his studio that I first met Wyndham Lewis. Ezra had not been boxing very long, and I was embarrassed at having him work in front of anyone he knew, and I tried to make him look as good as possible. But it was not very good, because he knew how to fence, and I was still working to make his left into his fencing hand and move his left foot forward always and bring his right foot up parallel with it. It was just basic moves. I was never able to teach him to throw a left hook, and to teach him to shorten his right was something for the future. Wyndham Lewis wore a wide black hat, like a character in the Quarter, and was dressed like someone out of La Boheme. He had a face that reminded me of a frog, not a bullfrog, but just any frog, and Paris was too big a puddle for him. At that time, we believed that any writer or painter could wear any clothes he owned, and there was no official uniform for the artist. But Lewis wore the uniform of a pre-war artist. It was embarrassing to see him, and he watched superciliously while I slipped Ezra's left leads or blocked them with an open right glove. I wanted us to stop, but Lewis insisted we go on, and I could see that, knowing nothing about what was going on, he was waiting, hoping, to see Ezra hurt. Nothing happened. I never countered, but kept Ezra moving after me, sticking out his left hand and throwing a few right hands, and then said we were through, and washed down with a pitcher of water, and toweled off and put on my sweatshirt. We had a drink of something, and I listened while Ezra and Lewis talked about people in London and Paris. I watched Lewis carefully, without seeming to look at him, as you do when you are boxing, and I did not think I had ever seen a nastier-looking man. Some people show evil as a great racehorse shows breeding. They have the dignity of a hard shank. Lewis did not show evil. He just looked nasty. Walking home, I tried to think what he reminded me of, and there were various things. They were all medical, except toe jam, and that was a slang word. I tried to break his face down and describe it, but I could only get the eyes. Under the black hat, when I had first seen them, the eyes had been those of an unsuccessful rapist. I met the nastiest man I've ever seen today, I told my wife. Tati, don't tell me about him, she said. Please don't tell me about him. We're just going to have dinner. About a week afterwards, I met Miss Stein and told her I'd met Wyndham Lewis and asked her if she had ever met him. I call him the measuring worm, she said. He comes over from London, and he sees a good picture and takes a pencil out of his pocket, and you watch him measuring it on the pencil with his thumb, sighting on it and measuring it and seeing exactly how it is done. Then he goes back to London and does it, and it doesn't come out right. He's missed what it's all about. So I thought of him as the measuring worm. It was a kinder and more Christian term than what I had thought about him myself. Later, I tried to like him and to be friends with him, as I did with nearly all of Ezra's friends when he explained them to me. But this was how he seemed to me on the first day I ever met him, in Ezra's studio. 12. A strange enough ending. The way it ended with Gertrude Stein was strange enough. We had become very good friends, and I had done a number of practical things for her, such as getting her long book started as a serial with Ford, and helping type the manuscript and reading her proof, and we were getting to be better friends than I could ever wish to be. There is not much future in men being friends with great women, although it can be pleasant enough before it gets better or worse, and there is usually even less future with truly ambitious women writers. One time when I gave the excuse for not having stopped in at 27 Rue de Fleurus for some time that I did not know whether Miss Stein would be at home, she said, "But Hemingway, you have the run of the place. Don't you know that? I mean it truly. Come in any time, and the maid-servant—she used her name, but I have forgotten it—will look after you, and you must make yourself at home until I come." I did not abuse this, but sometimes I would stop in, and the maid-servant would give me a drink, and I would look at the pictures, and if Miss Stein did not turn up, I would thank the maid-servant and leave a message and go away. Miss Stein and a companion were getting ready to go south in Miss Stein's car, and on this day Miss Stein had asked me to come by in the forenoon to say goodbye. She had asked me to come and visit, Hadley and I staying at an hotel, before and after this trip, and we had written many letters. But Hadley and I had other plans and other places where we wanted to go. Naturally, you say nothing about this, but you can still hope to go, and then it is impossible. It was something that we never learned. You should know a little about the system of not visiting people. You had to learn it. Much later, Picasso told me that he always promised the rich to come when they asked him, because it made them so happy, and then something would happen, and he would be unable to appear. But that had nothing to do with Miss Stein, and he said it about other people. It was a lovely spring day, and I walked down from the Place de l'Observatoire through the Little Luxembourg. The horse chestnut trees were in blossom, and there were many children playing on the graveled walks with their nurses sitting on the benches, and I saw wood pigeons in the trees and heard others that I could not see. The maidservant opened the door before I rang and told me to come in and to wait. Miss Stein would be down at any moment. It was before noon, but the maidservant poured me a glass of eau-de-vie, put it in my hand, and winked happily. The colorless alcohol felt good on my tongue, and it was still in my mouth when I heard someone speaking to Miss Stein as I had never heard one person speak to another. Never. Anywhere. Ever. Then Miss Stein's voice came pleading and begging, saying,
"Don't, pussy. Don't. Don't. Please don't. I'll do anything, pussy, but please. Don't do it. Please don't. Please don't, pussy."
I swallowed the drink and put the glass down on the table and started for the door. The maidservant shook her finger at me and whispered,
"Don't go. She'll be right down."
"I have to go," I said, and tried not to hear any more as I left, but it was still going on, and the only way I could not hear it was to be gone. It was bad to hear, and the answers were worse. In the courtyard, I said to the maidservant, "Please say I came to the courtyard and met you, that I could not wait because a friend is sick. Say bon voyage for me. I will write." "C'est entendu, monsieur. What a shame you cannot wait." "Yes," I said. "What a shame." That was the way it finished for me, stupidly enough. Although I still did the small jobs, made the necessary appearances, brought people that were asked for, and waited dismissal with most of the other men friends when that epoch came and the new friends moved in. It was sad to see new worthless pictures hung in with the great pictures, but it made no difference anymore. Not to me, it didn't. She quarreled with nearly all of us that were fond of her, except Juan Gris, and she couldn't quarrel with him because he was dead. I'm not sure that he would have cared because he was past caring, and it showed in his paintings. Finally, she even quarreled with the new friends, but none of us followed it anymore. She got to look like a Roman emperor, and that was fine if you liked your women to look like Roman emperors. But Picasso had painted her, and I could remember her when she looked like a woman from Friuli. In the end, everyone, or not quite everyone, made friends again in order not to be stuffy or righteous. I did too. But I could never make friends again truly, neither in my heart nor in my head. When you cannot make friends anymore in your head is the worst. It never occurred to me until many years later that anyone could hate anyone because they had learned to write conversation from that novel that started off with a quotation from The Garage Keeper. But it was really much more complicated than that. 13. The Man Who Was Marked for Death. The afternoon I met Ernest Walsh, the poet, in Ezra's studio. He was with two girls in long mink coats, and there was a long, shiny hired car from Claridge's outside in the street with a uniformed chauffeur. The girls were blondes, and they had crossed on the same ship with Walsh. The ship had arrived the day before, and he had brought them with him to visit Ezra. Ernest Walsh was dark, intense, faultlessly Irish, poetic, and clearly marked for death, as a character is marked for death in a motion picture. He was talking to Ezra, and I talked with the girls, who asked me if I had read Mr. Walsh's poems. I had not, and one of them brought out a green-covered copy of Harriet Munro's Poetry, a magazine of verse, and showed me poems by Walsh in it. "He gets $1,200 apiece," she said. "For each poem," the other girl said. My recollection was that I received $12 a page, if that, from the same magazine. "He must be a very great poet," I said. "It's more than Eddie Guest gets," the first girl told me. "It's more than Who's That Other Poet gets, you know." "Kipling," her friend said. "It's more than anybody gets ever," the first girl said. "Are you staying in Paris very long?" I asked them. "Well, no, not really. We're with a group of friends." We came over on this boat, you know, but there wasn't anyone on it, really. Mr. Walsh was on it, of course.
Doesn't he play cards? I asked.
She looked at me in a disappointed but understanding way.
No, he doesn't have to. Not writing poetry the way he can write it.
What ship are you going back on?
Well, that depends. It depends on the boats and on a lot of things. Are you going back?
No. I'm getting by all right.
This is sort of the poor quarter over here, isn't it?
Yes, but it's pretty good. I work the cafes and I'm out at the track.
Can you go out to the track in those clothes?
No. This is my cafe outfit.
It's kind of cute, one of the girls said. I'd like to see some of that cafe life. Wouldn't you, dear?
I would, the other girl said. I wrote their names down in my address book and promised to call them at Claridge's. They were nice girls, and I said goodbye to them and to Walsh and to Ezra. Walsh was still talking to Ezra with great intensity.
Don't forget, the taller one of the girls said.
How could I? I told her, and shook hands with them both again. The next I heard from Ezra about Walsh was that he had been bailed out of Claridge's by some lady admirers of poetry and of young poets who were marked for death, and the next thing, some time after that, was that he had financial backing from another source and was going to start a new magazine in the quarter as a co-editor. At the time, The Dial, an American literary magazine edited by Schofield Thayer, gave an annual award of, I believe, $1,000 for excellence in the practice of letters by a contributor. This was a huge sum for any straight writer to receive in those days, in addition to the prestige, and the award had gone to various people, all deserving, naturally. Two people, then, could live comfortably and well in Europe on $5 a day and could travel. The advance I had received from an American publisher on my first full-length book of short stories was $200, and supplemented by loans and savings, it meant a winter to ski and write in the Vorarlberg. This quarter, of which Walsh was one of the editors, was alleged to be going to award a very substantial sum to the contributor whose work should be judged the best at the end of the first four issues. If the news was passed around by gossip or rumor, or if it was a matter of personal confidence, cannot be said. Let us hope and believe always that it was completely honorable in every way. Certainly nothing could ever be said or imputed against Walsh's co-editor, ever. It was not long after I heard rumors of this alleged award that Walsh asked me to lunch one day at a restaurant that was the best and the most expensive in the Boulevard Saint-Michel quarter, and after the oysters, expensive, flat, faintly coppery marraine, not the familiar, deep, inexpensive Portuguese, and a bottle of Puy Fuissé, began to lead up to it delicately. He appeared to be conning me, as he had conned the shills from the boat, if they were shills, and if he had conned them, of course. And when he asked me if I would like another dozen of the flat oysters, as he called them, I said I would like them very much. He did not bother to look marked for death with me, and this was a relief. He knew I knew he had the con. Not the kind you con with, but the kind you died of then, and how bad it was. And he did not bother to have to cough, and I was grateful for this at the table. I was wondering if he ate the flat oysters in the same way the whores in Kansas City, who were marked for death and practically everything else, always wished to swallow semen as a sovereign remedy against the con. But I did not ask him. I began my second dozen of the flat oysters, picking them from their bed of crushed ice on the silver plate, watching their unbelievably delicate brown edges react and cringe as I squeezed lemon juice on them and separated the holding muscle from the shell and lifted them to chew them carefully. "Ezra's a great, great poet," Walsh said, looking at me with his own dark poet's eyes. "Yes," I said, "and a fine man." "Noble," Walsh said, "truly noble." We ate and drank in silence as a tribute to Ezra's nobility. I missed Ezra and wished he were there. He could not afford Maren either. "Joyce is great," Walsh said. "Great, great." "Great," I said, "and a good friend." We had become friends in his wonderful period after the finishing of Ulysses and before starting what was called for a long time work in progress. I thought of Joyce and remembered many things.
"I wish his eyes were better," Walsh said.
"So does he," I said.
"It is the tragedy of our time," Walsh told me.
"Everybody has something wrong with them," I said, trying to cheer up the lunch.
"You haven't."
He gave me all his charm and more, and then he marked himself for death.
"You mean I am not marked for death?" I asked. I could not help it. "No, you're marked for life."
He capitalized the word. "Give me time," I said. He wanted a good steak, rare, and I ordered 2 tornados with sauce béarnaise. I figured the butter would be good for him.
"What about a red wine?" he asked.
The sommelier came, and I ordered a Chateau Neuf du Pape. I would walk it off afterwards along the quay. He could sleep it off, or do what he wanted to. I might take mine someplace, I thought. It came as we finished the steak and French fried potatoes, and were 2/3 through the Chateau Neuf du Pape, which is not a luncheon wine.
"There's no use beating around the bush," he said. "You know you're to get the award, don't you?"
"Am I?" I said. "Why?"
"You're to get it," he said.
He started to talk about my writing, and I stopped listening. I was embarrassed, and it made me feel sick for people to talk about my writing to my face. And I looked at him, and his marked-for-death look, and I thought, "You con man conning me with your con. I've seen a battalion in the dust on the road, 1/3 of them for death or worse, and no special marks on them. The dust was for all, and you and your marked-for-death look, you con man, making a living out of your death. Now you will con me. Con not, lest thou be not conned." Death was not conning with him. It was coming all right. "I don't think I deserve it, Ernest," I said, enjoying using my own name that I hated to him. "Besides, Ernest, it would not be ethical, Ernest."
"It's strange we have the same name, isn't it?"
"Yes, Ernest," I said. "It's a name we must both live up to. You see what I mean, don't you, Ernest?"
"Yes, Ernest," he said.
He gave me complete, sad Irish understanding and the charm. So I was always very nice to him and to his magazine. And when he had his hemorrhages and left Paris asking me to see his magazine through the printers who did not read English, I did that. I had seen one of the hemorrhages. It was very legitimate. And I knew that he would die all right. And it pleased me at that time, which was a difficult time in my life, to be extremely nice to him, as it pleased me to call him Ernest. Also, I liked and admired his co-editor. She had not promised me any award. She only wished to build a good magazine and pay her contributors well. One day, years later, I met Joyce, who was walking along the Boulevard Saint-Germain after having been to a matinee alone. He liked to listen to the actors, although he could not see them. He asked me to have a drink with him, and we went to the Deux Magots and ordered dry sherry, although you will always read that he drank only Swiss white wine.
"Now about Walsh," Joyce said.
"A such-and-such alive is a such-and-such dead," I said.
"Did he promise you that award?" Joyce asked.
"Yes."
"I thought so," Joyce said.
"Did he promise it to you?"
"Yes," Joyce said.
After a time, he asked, Do you think he promised it to Pound? I don't know. Best not to ask him, Joyce said. We left it at that. I cannot remember when Walsh died.